It's the takeaway for December 31st, last show of the year. I'm Sean Carlson in for Tanzina Vega. Today on the podcast, a number of recent anti-Semitic incidents have American Jewish communities on edge.
I only hear fear for their safety, their children's safety, and the safety of all citizens.
We'll hear from Jewish leaders on how officials can best respond to these attacks going forward.
Where are the Martin Luther King Juniors in the world today to be able to stand up and get that kind of attention? There's a vacuum, and that vacuum is really profoundly silent.
Also this hour, many U.S. immigrants don't have access to their birth certificates, which means that January 1st becomes their official birthday.
For a lot of the individuals that have the January 1st birth date that are recent immigrants and recent arrivals in the U.S., it's a reminder of what they've left behind back home. It's a reminder of the challenges they face at home. It's a reminder of what their homeland is going through.
We start with the response to anti-Semitic attacks in the U.S. Let's begin.
This is an intolerant time in this country. We see anger, we see hatred exploding. It is an American cancer in the body politic.
Increasing series of anti-Semitic hate crimes in the New York City area and across the country.
A consistent pattern of attacks against people based on their faith.
Five people were stabbed at the home of a rabbi in Rockland County, New York, Saturday night.
We're neighbors in this great county, and we are united to help battle this terrible cancer, this hatred, this bigotry, this terrorism.
Grafton has experienced a long history of mental health, and that should be the focus, not terrorism.
If it had been attacks against the members of the black community, we would have stood up and spoke out. We cannot remain silent.
We are fighting back. Regardless of what the motivations are, the fact of the matter is we cannot sit around and do nothing.
You do infrastructure strengthening, cameras, tougher doors, fencing, the hiring of personnel, security guards, and others.
Last night I lit my seventh candle. And when I lit the candle, I said, I hope there's not going to be another anti-Semitic incident the way they were with the prior 6 days. Unfortunately, that wish didn't happen.
On Saturday night, a man entered the home of a Hasidic rabbi in Muncie, New York during a Hanukkah celebration and stabbed five people. And this came just days after New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio issued a response to his city's rise in anti-Semitism. That's after a number of anti-Semitic assaults had been reported in a matter of days. And the mayor spoke out again after the stabbing in Muncie.
Well, there's a deep, deep connection between the Muncie community and New York City, and particularly Brooklyn. The attack on that community is an attack on this community, is an attack on all of us. We feel it that way.
These most recent attacks came less than a month after six people were killed when a gunman targeted a kosher grocery store in New Jersey, and a little more than a year after 11 people were shot and killed at the Tree of Life in Pittsburgh. In the last few years, the Anti-Defamation League has reported that incidents of anti-Semitism have reached some of the highest numbers since they began recording them 3 decades ago. Joining us now is Rabbi David Niederman. He's the president of the United Jewish Organizations of Williamsburg and North Brooklyn. Rabbi, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Also with us is Rachel Glickhaus, a journalist and partner manager for ProPublica's Documenting Hate Project. Hey, Rachel, thanks for being here to share your insights.
Thank you for having me.
So, Rabbi, you work closely with people living both in New Jersey and New York communities who have seen some of these recent attacks. What have you been hearing from people?
I only hear fear for their safety, their children's safety, and the safety of all citizens. It's very scary. They go out and I'm not sure, am I coming back? But the recent one, what showed its real ugly face of anti-Semitism, is no longer you met in the street, I hate you, and I do something, but I'm ready to come in to your home when you perform a religious ceremony at home and come in with a butcher knife with the intention, premeditated intention, to go and kill. This is something that every human being has to stand up and say, this is much, much more. We have to stop it right now. Hate has no place.
And Rachel, we've seen, as we mentioned, a number of anti-Semitic incidents here in New York City. Maybe not at the same level of violence that happened in Jersey City or Muncie, Can you walk us through some of those incidents here in New York?
Basically, over the past year, we have seen a series of assaults, harassment, incidents in the street, particularly in Brooklyn. And there have been a series of them going on and on that led up to a new series of incidents over the past couple of weeks that included assaults in Brooklyn and obviously the incidents we discussed. So these violent incidents in Muncie, in Jersey City, didn't come out of nowhere.
And Rabbi, you mentioned feeling unsafe in your own community. How does that feel for someone living in what is the largest Jewish community in the world outside of Israel?
You see, it feels terrible because remember we are coming from. This community has built itself up on the ashes of the Holocaust. Coming to the United States, the country of freedom, we know will be free and we'll be able to reestablish our Jewish communities here in New York. And it worked for 75 years. And now it is, unfortunately, the older people say they're afraid if this is not the start of something very, very serious. I don't want to call it by its name. So people in the community who experience that, who know that we are a persecuted minority, fear for their life, the future of their children and grandchildren.
And unfortunately, anti-Semitism, it's not new, even here in New York City. So can you tell us, Rachel, if you have a sense from your research of why we're seeing an explosion of this violence lately?
I honestly really can't tell you why. I wish we had some better reporting around this, particularly in New York City, to understand why we've just seen this uptick, particularly in violence. What I will tell you is that nationally, what we see is the majority of anti-Semitic incidents, the ones we know about that are documented through the FBI data, through news reports, is that the majority of them are vandalism. So they tend to be nonviolent. Swastikas, damaging synagogues, those types of things. Whereas New York City tends to be an outlier with anti-Semitic hate incidents that tend to be more violent in nature.
Are there more specific Jewish communities that are being targeted over other ones?
I'm not sure it's easy to say that. But what I will say is that Hasidic and Orthodox communities tend to be the ones that are targeted for physical violence because of their appearance. So that's why synagogues around the country of all types are targeted in vandalism incidents. But when it comes to people, it tends to be those communities because they're more visible.
And Rabbi, aside from the violent attacks, you mentioned that these kinds of things are things that you've experienced for years and you've been seeing or feeling for years. Can you talk about how anti-Semitism is taking shape in the communities you work and live in, aside from some, say, violent attacks?
So you've been in the newspapers, you have been seeing so many times how they dehumanize the Orthodox and Hasidic community. And this just escalates. You know, it takes time, it escalates, it gets, if we don't have people, everybody, lay people, government, at the dinner tables and at the restaurants, people to say, you cannot discriminate and not talk down and definitely not violate the rights of anybody. Hate against one is hate against all. Let us understand that. So fine, I'm more visible, and therefore I am a target. But let us understand, anti-Semitism means anti-Jewish and anti-religion. That is not what our founding fathers were looking for the United States, and the United States to look like. That's not what democracy is, and that should be stopped by all walks of life. And laws have to be created to deal with this violent, violent anti-Semitism. Laws have to be updated. Place of worship has to be protected. Go all over Europe, you'll see police, and they're protecting. This goes on for years. Here, unfortunately, we see how deadly this becomes. Government has a responsibility. What do we want from government? Safe streets, clean my garbage. That's the two basic needs that we want. Mm-hmm. The first thing is to be safe. Safe in the street and safe at home and safe to practice my religion.
What are people saying in your communities about what they would want, say, the state or local or federal government to do?
You asked before, what is the issues behind that? And the answer to that is we don't know. And it's the responsibility of a task force, federal, state, and city, to come up and say, study these fast. It's time for blue ribbons, commissions. Get to the fact. You have all the data. Unfortunately, you don't share that with us. FOIL requests are not answered inappropriately. You have the information. It's your responsibility of government of all levels to work together and stop this violent, dangerous attacks against the Jewish community and any other community.
Yeah, freedom of information requests, when you say FOIA requests, getting information from the government about these kinds of things.
Yes.
So, Rachel, speaking of data, when we look at the perpetrators of these crimes, are there any links that we can draw between them?
I don't think so. One of the problems we have in general is that the data is just so hard to come by to have a complete picture. More than half of hate crime victims don't report to police, so that is already a huge amount of people that we simply don't know about and incidents we don't know about. We know that not every police department reports their data to the FBI, meaning that our national data is really lacking. And also what we've discovered through our project is that some police just don't do a good job tracking these types of crimes or just storing the data internally. So by the time it gets to the FBI, those numbers are incorrect. So being able to even have a sense of the scope of these crimes and the perpetrators is really difficult just based on the fact that the data is lacking.
So,
yeah, go please, Rabbi.
What Rachel said is very troubling, and what has to happen is a law that everybody has to report it to the FBI. As I say, everything has to be reported. And the reason why people don't report, let us understand, because they see it as a revolving door, not leading to anything, because you never get back the information what happens to the people who perpetrated the crime. You want to stop crime, you have to empower the people to know that when they report something, it is worth something, it means something, and might save their or their neighbor's life.
Rabbi David Niederman is the president of United Jewish Organizations of Williamsburg and North Brooklyn, and Rachel Glickhouse is a partner manager for ProPublica's Documenting Hate Project. We're going to continue our conversation now on anti-Semitism in the U.S. For now, we're joined by Rabbi Jeffrey Myers. He's the leader of the Tree of Life in Pittsburgh. On October 27th, 2018, a gunman shot and killed 11 people in an attack on Rabbi Meyer's congregation. Rabbi, we want to thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
As we've been hearing, we just heard from Rabbi David Niederman about the way his community in the New York area has been responding to this recent string of anti-Semitic attacks. Did anything he say resonate with you and what you've been hearing in your community in Pittsburgh?
Deja vu, hearing the outrage of what happened to the Muncie community is certainly a flashback to the days and weeks after October 27th.
When you heard about the attack in Muncie, what went through your mind?
Two words, not again.
And the very next morning, two people were killed by a gunman at a church in White Settlement, Texas. The gunman was also shot and killed. Do you think that deadly attacks in places of worship like this have become a new normal?
I wish we wouldn't use those words, but clearly there's something going on in the United States that we've become this incredible center for mass murders. I recall doing a little research not that long ago for a sermon that since the slaughter in the schoolhouse in Sandy Hook in Newtown, there have been something in the neighborhood of 2,400 days since that slaughter, and there have been over 2,000 mass murders. So it's literally like saying a mass murder a day in, 7 years. What is going on in our country? Because if you look around the world, we are far beyond the center for mass murder on the planet.
One of the things that's been part of the public discourse in the past couple of days, and it seems like such a bizarre juxtaposition, but in the case of the Texas attack, the shooter was shot and killed by two parishioners who were volunteers on the security force who were armed at the church. Since the attack on the Tree of Life over a year ago, how have you thought about whether or not there should be more armed security in places of worship?
The answer, regrettably, is simple. There must be. For years, all houses of worship, and not just synagogues, churches, mosques, temples, have struggled with the challenge of providing appropriate security for parishioners versus being open and welcoming to all who wish to come and pray. But you see, for example, in Mother Emanuel in Charleston, young man walks in, sits and studies Bible with them in what would be the normal process, and then takes out a gun and slaughters 9 people in Mother Emanuel. So how do you balance the need to be an open and welcoming place with security? Do we have to have a religious version of the TSA where everyone has to be carefully checked before they enter a house of worship? Those are questions that all houses of worship, particularly synagogues, continue to struggle with to come up with answers. There is no one answer. Everyone has to take into account their communal needs, and regrettably, what can they afford? Because security is not cheap.
Have you been following the response from elected officials in New York and New Jersey about these attacks, and how do you feel about that response?
It becomes sort of a virtual Groundhog Day of the same sets of responses, and then everything quiets down until the next one. And it's all good and fine that we have these verbal responses, but clearly that's insufficient. Just because someone is going to pronounce that this must stop, that doesn't mean it stops. There's no Harry Potter wand that we can shake that makes it go away. I appreciate all the support that you get from elected officials, but it's not enough.
If you had the ear of leaders in Congress and in the White House, and there very well could be elected officials listening at this moment, what would you tell them about what they should do or whether or not they're taking it seriously enough?
I would say to them this first. There is too much uncivil discourse in Washington, D.C. No political party owns that. They're all guilty of that. And when they model uncivil discourse, they give us, ordinary citizens, permission to behave the same way because they show it. And they say to us, it's okay to behave and speak that way. I would say to them, there needs to be a very strong, passionate response from our leaders to say, this is unacceptable. That's the minimum. They need to be able to say, this is un-American. America is built on a country with two sacred documents, the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. We have enough phrases in there that outline what we aspire to as a country. When anti-Semitism reaches the levels that it's reached, it says to me, we're failing as America when people feel they have the right to attack, attempt to murder, and in the case of Tree of Life, murder Jews because it's okay to do that. And that's a serious failure of America. We need elected leaders. We need religious leaders of all faiths. We need to stand together with one firm voice to be able to say, this is not okay in America. And where are the Martin Luther King Jr.'s of blessed memory in the world today to be able to stand up and get that kind of attention? There's a vacuum, and that vacuum is really troubling and also profoundly silent.
I can't believe that this is a question that we have to ask in 2019 for all of the obvious reasons, but I think it's important for people to hear from a leader in the Jewish community about this. What would you want to say to people who want to essentially hide their faith, who fear lighting a menorah during Hanukkah?
I've experienced that. I've seen and I've heard from people. I've seen the fear in their faces, and that troubles me. I say to them that we need to be proud of who we are. The Jewish community has been present in the United States for 355 years. No anti-Semite is going to stop us from doing Jewish.
Rabbi Jeffrey Myers is the rabbi at Tree of Life in Pittsburgh. Rabbi, thank you so much for joining us.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, of course, is January 1st, which for many immigrants to the U.S. is more than just the start of a new year. Thousands of people who resettle here are assigned a New Year's birthday by U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, and that's because at the time of their arrival, they don't have access to their birth certificates. In countries like Syria, Libya, and Yemen, recent unrest has pushed people out on a moment's notice, giving them no time to collect their documents. And in others, like Iraq and Afghanistan, war has ravaged the country for decades, with infrastructure issues damaging birth records or making them impossible to access. This is something Abed Ayoub knows well. He's the National Legal and Policy Director at American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee in Washington, D.C. Abed, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, and thank you for having me with you today.
So can you tell us why January 1st is the date? Is it just a coincidence or is it a bureaucratic reason for choosing the first day of the year?
The decision to put the January date is one made by the immigration officer. So if an individual is going through the refugee process or is entering the U.S. in other ways, they don't have their official birth date. Oftentimes what was done in the past was they would put January 1st in the year they were born. This is not a new phenomenon. In fact, it's something that many within at least within the Arab community, are very familiar with, and something many of our ancestors and relatives who first came to the U.S. faced, you know, upon their arrival. So this is something we've been seeing for, as I said, for decades now.
Where did it get its start? If you say it's been happening for decades, what was the genesis?
The start most likely began at Ellis Island, when individuals would come here initially in the, you know, 30s, 40s, 50s, and they didn't know their exact birth date, but they knew the year. They would just put down January 1st in the year. The reason we're seeing now is that simply they were destroyed. If you look at Syria and what's happening in the civil war out there and the violence in different provinces, the, you know, government buildings were destroyed, the records were destroyed, so they're simply not available. If you look at Iraq, what happened in Iraq the past two decades, records were destroyed. The main reason we're seeing now is violence and is destruction, physical destruction of the records. A lot of these records were not backed up to servers. A lot of them were handwritten or kept in drawers or kept as you imagine they would be 20 or 30 years ago. So it's a matter of just being physically destroyed.
Can you walk us through how this works, legally speaking? You know, if someone gets to the U.S. and they have to establish a new birthday, how does that work from a legal perspective?
Well, from a legal perspective, it just depends how they're entering and what status they're trying to obtain. So each case is going to be different. There are ways to piece together, and albeit it is more difficult without a birth certificate or an official birthday, but there are ways to piece together one's identity if that information is missing. And it is hard, it is difficult, and very tedious, but it can be done. But when you do have that birth certificate, things are easier. You're able to come in here, show who you are, and prove your identity. But, you know, without those documentations, things are harder for an already stressed situation.
Yeah, and you mentioned the birthday is just the first step right here. So how does one build a legal identity without paperwork, without official documentation?
It's very difficult. You have to, again, go back to each country may have a different set of registrations. It could go down to each village how we can get registration. So it is like an investigative process on trying to put things together, whether it be affidavits from family members, affidavits from the religious leaders, something to prove this individual is who he or she says they are.
And how does it affect the naturalization process? If you're coming in and trying to come into the country and stay here, does this choosing of January 1st change that all or make it more difficult?
Most of the challenges faced when you don't have your birth certificate or birth dates happen at the beginning. So once they overcome that hurdle the first time and prove their identity, whether it be through obtaining different documents or through affidavits, as we mentioned, once you establish your identity that first time and you are given that birth date, things should be okay as you move along the process. So if somebody came here in the 80s and they were given that January 1st birth date and they've gone their whole life and then now they decide to apply for citizenship, they should have no problem. What's important to keep in mind here is beyond just the birthday. This signifies an issue that we have to look deeper into. For many of these individuals, especially now that are facing this problem, the January birth date reflects a lot on the issues they're facing back home. When you look at that January birth date, you have to look at it a little deeper. They're given this January 1st birth date most likely because they fled a war zone or a humanitarian crisis. This is reflective of the challenges these individuals are already facing. So every day they look at that birth date that they've been given is a reminder to them that, you know, my homeland is under attack, or my homeland is going through difficult times, or a civil war, or something that is preventing them from going back, or something that's even preventing them from proving who they are and having something as basic as a birth certificate. So as humorous as some may find it that, oh, your birthday is January 1st, or I have, you know, 200 Facebook friends with a January 1st birth date, as humorous as that may sound, there is a seriousness to it. And the seriousness is these individuals are coming from a land that's going through difficult times. They're coming from a country that's already, again, it's maybe under a natural disaster, man-made disaster, civil war, violence, and they have to deal with even more pressures and more stresses on trying to prove that they're a human, on trying to prove that they're alive.
Does having January 1st as a birthday or not having the paperwork to have a birthday in terms of civil society at all, does it affect people's access to humanitarian services or rights?
Absolutely. Not having a birth certificate will prevent you from obtaining travel documents you need, whether it be in Europe or across the Middle East or even here in the U.S., could prevent you from obtaining the health care that you need. Not having a birthday is very problematic and will lead to more difficulties as they try to move on with their lives day by day.
And what have people told you about what it means for their identities? That's obviously a more esoteric question, but for their sense of self. I think we take it for granted that our birthday means so much to us and says so much about us. You know, I'm a Gemini, you know. What do people tell you about January 1st or other dates in terms of how they see themselves?
For a lot of the individuals that have the January 1st birth date that are recent immigrants and recent arrivals in the U.S., it's a reminder of what they've left behind back home. It's a reminder of the challenges they face at home. It's a reminder of what their homeland is going through. And that's difficult for many of them to know that everything has been destroyed, even the documents proving your existence have been destroyed. So it's very difficult for them. For a lot of other individuals that came here, you know, in 1950s and after that we know, they just see it as a reflection of the way things were done back home, that, you know, we didn't have a registrar in the village. We didn't have accurate record keeping. That's just the way it is. That's just how it was in parts of Lebanon or Syria or Jordan. And it's accepted that that's how things are. So there's a lot of different takes on the birthday, and it's very reflective of the diversity in that we have in that part of the world and the way things are done.
Can you share a story about someone maybe in your own life that's changed their birthdays when they arrived to the U.S.?
Well, the most common story we have are individuals that came here, you know, with the wave, the immigrant wave in the 50s and 60s, coming here for jobs at Ford in my hometown of Dearborn. And the most common story you hear is my parents didn't have a birth certificate and January 1 is my birthday. Those are the individuals I know. That sounds like a bland story, but this is the most common story. This is what we hear a lot of. And a lot of them are, you know, citizens now. A lot of them have their own children now, and they celebrate their birthday on January 1st as you would on any other day of the year.
Abhad Ayyub is the National Legal and Policy Director at American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee in Washington, D.C. Abhad, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Hi, everybody. Sean Carlson in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. And on this December 31st, we want to take a second to look back on the year in news through your eyes. And while D.C. dominated so many of the headlines, we asked you what stories not focused on politics really affected you this year and why. Some of you told us that some of the big stories of the year made you active and engaged in new ways or spurred you to make changes in your own lives.
This is Deborah Lebel calling from North Andover, Massachusetts. One of the stories that moved me in 2019 centered around working conditions in warehouses and distribution centers. I heard stories about people who were literally worked to death, pregnant women having miscarriages, high rates of injuries on the job. So that made me change my behavior, like I no longer opt for two-day shipping. It also made me wonder why Jeff Bezos has a net worth of $155 billion, but a pregnant woman has to lift heavy boxes in a distribution center for 12 hours a day and $12 an hour.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth Grant Gibson. I'm calling from Natchez, Mississippi. For me, all of the news is political, and specifically my concern is the increase in detention of immigrants in Louisiana, where one in six of the immigrants being detained in the entire U.S. are living in prisons. I am doing what I can to help, along with a group of friends. I'm visiting detainees. I'm writing letters to detainees. I am trying to educate my friends about asylum. And I am raising money to put onto detainees' accounts. That's what I'm working on.
And for others, it was the stories that happened in your world that really made an impact.
Hello, this is Steve from Newport, Oregon. The non-political story that I have been following and I'm interested in for the next year will be the federal designation of cannabis, removing it as a Category 1 narcotic. I'm a recreational grower, and a change in this will be big changes in the fledgling industry. Hopefully it'll happen soon, but you never know.
For some of you, stories of immense loss stuck with you the most.
Hello, this is Victoria calling from Minneapolis. One of the things in the news that has really devastated me is the loss of millions of wildlife in Australia due to the heat and the fires. It's just heartbreaking, and the images don't leave me. It makes me very sad.
Hi, this is Mary from Philadelphia. The news story that affected me the most this past year were the crashes of those Boeing 737s, each one with the loss of hundreds of lives. It's chilling, to say the least.
Those are some hard memories of 2019. We want to thank you for sharing those calls. And as for me, this year, I could not get enough of Greta Thunberg. She's the Swedish teen and climate activist who gained a name for herself for unabashedly calling out the powers that be.
For about a year, I've been constantly talking about our rapidly declining carbon budgets over and over again. But since that is still being ignored, I will just keep repeating it.
And as a millennial, I feel like it's pretty easy to be cynical. For many of us, our political consciousness was forged by things like 9/11 and war and the Great Recession. And let's face it, 2019 has not been the brightest year in recent memory. But seeing Thunberg and other people of her generation so passionately and eloquently both organize and advocate for what they believe in has been pretty inspiring. And it gives me hope that 2020 will bring a new tone and a new urgency to issues we all should be thinking about. So thanks to you all for sharing. We'll keep hearing your voices throughout 2020 here on The Takeaway. I'm Sean Carlson. You can feel free to reach out to me. I'm @SeanEcarl on Twitter. This is The Takeaway.